Likewise.
This is John Crumshaw for KPFK with a special Politics or Pedagogy Education Report. Please make your contribution at 818-985-5735 or pledge online at kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. Various Israeli officials have hailed Trump's victory since Tuesday. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called it, quote, history's greatest comeback, end quote. His new defense minister stated, quote, together we'll strengthen the U.S.-Israeli alliance, end quote. And the Israeli national security minister said, quote, God bless Trump, end quote. And Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to Washington, stated that Trump, quote, has the most pro-Israel record of any president. The hope is here that there'll be more of the same, end quote. When Trump was president, he unlawfully recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, falsely declared that Israel was sovereign over the occupied Golan Heights in Syria, and said that the Israeli settlements on Palestinian land were legal despite their violation of international law and prior U.S. policy to the contrary. Trump also brokered the Abraham Accords, a series of agreements with some Arab states to establish diplomatic and economic ties with Israel. Since Trump left office, Israel's violence toward Palestinians only escalated with Israel's ongoing genocidal campaign in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, having killed more than 43,000 Palestinians and displaced nearly all of the 2.3 million residents of Gaza. And while the Biden administration has been complicit in this genocide, arming Israel to the teeth to carry it out, and with Harris refusing to distance herself from Joe Biden's continued support for Israel's genocide, Trump, if he had been president during the past 4 years instead of Biden, would have also supported the genocide, as he made evident when he said the Israelis should, quote, finish what they started and get it over with fast, end quote, thereby favoring the ethnic cleansing of all Palestinians from Gaza. So with a second Trump administration, and with all of his extreme rhetoric and campaign promises, some of which have been a direct echo of Nazi rhetoric, there are serious concerns over what policies could be passed and implemented as it relates to immigration, climate, abortion, labor, education, and U.S. foreign policy. While Trump would like folks to believe that he is all-powerful, it is important to remember that he is not. And to better understand what checks could there be on a newly emboldened Donald Trump once he takes office. As Sam Rosenthal, political director of Roots Action, writes, quote, a good place to look for hints about how Trump's first 100 days in office might unfold is his last first 100 days. Trump issued executive orders and signed bills at a rapid clip in his first 100 days in office, outpaced by only two presidents in the modern era. Some observers noted that many of these bills and executive orders were cosmetic. End quote. Sam Rosenthal goes on to note that while some of Trump's executive orders in his last first 100 days did have lasting effects, Trump then and now continues to, quote, make promises that stretch plausibility and sometimes the bounds of material reality, end quote. What many have forgotten is that in 2017, when Trump began his first term, Republicans had trifecta control of the federal government. Republicans controlled the House and the Senate, and despite that, Trump's legislative successes during the 115th Congress have been viewed as comparatively modest. So, with us today to understand, based on the last Trump administration, what checks there could be on a newly emboldened Donald Trump once he takes office, and to help shed light on what of his campaign promises stretch plausibility and sometimes the bounds of material reality, is our guest, Sam Rosenthal. Sam Rosenthal is a political director at Roots Action. He is also an outgoing steering member of Democratic Socialists of America's National Electoral Commission. Sam Rosenthal, welcome to Middle East in Focus.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I have to say that I really appreciated your articles. I think that there is a lot of fear out there, a lot of fear-induced rhetoric that's being put out there. And what I really appreciated about your work and your articles is that it's really sort of shedding light on, you know, what are, in fact, the limits to his power, despite a lot of the rhetoric that's putting out there in terms of him having limitless power. So I want to get into some of the things that you've written about. And one of the things you state in your article, quote, "A good place to look, as I mentioned in my intro, for hints about how Trump's first 100 days in office might unfold is his last 100 days. And the fact that Trump had issued a series of executive orders during that first last 100 days. Now, before we get into the specifics around those executive orders during his last first 100 days, can you first explain for folks, because I'm not sure that everybody fully understands, what is an executive order and what can an executive order do and what can't it do?
Sure. Yeah, I think that's an important place to start. So executive orders are directives from the president. And traditionally, they're supposed to be, or they're viewed as directives about the operations of the federal government, how the federal government should be managed. So these aren't actually described in the Constitution. They're sort of implied, scholars say. They don't have many limits on what they can address. But one of the big limitations on executive orders is that they're not, president can't use them to pass a budget or to overturn laws that are set in Congress. But they do have the force of law, quote, force of law, scholars say. So in some cases, they're sort of, in terms of application and interpretation, they're interchangeable with laws that Congress sets. But presidents cannot spend taxpayer dollars through executive orders. So that's one of the major impediments to executing policy solely via executive order. I think for someone like Trump, executive orders are really appealing because they sort of have the varnish of rule by fiat, which for someone with autocratic impulses is very appealing, I think. But when it comes to carrying out really large scale policy that requires a lot of funding, presidents still do have to run through Congress to get those sort of things accomplished. Although, you know, presidents have found many loopholes for finding the funding they need. And I think we can talk about that a bit more, especially when we talk about some of the EOs, as they're called, that Trump actually did put into effect during his first term.
So let's now get into that in terms of some of the executive orders during his first term that he passed. I want to first start with the ones that you described, or and as well as other observers described, as being more, quote, cosmetic. Can you give us some examples of this where Trump's messaging and rhetoric about the orders didn't actually match what the orders in fact said?
Sure. Yeah. And it's exactly as you say. When I say cosmetic, I don't mean they did nothing. I mean that there was a vast gulf between what Trump described them as doing and what they were actually doing. So one of the most prominent examples of this is the EO that Trump issued around the construction of his border wall. I think everyone who remembers his 2016 campaign remembers that he ran a lot on building this wall. Build the wall was one of the campaign slogans you saw most at Trump rallies. And, you know, he was promising effectively to build a border wall that ran the length of the entire southern border that was 30 feet high or something like that. So obviously a massive undertaking, a massive requirement in terms of budgeting. So when Trump got into office, he did issue this executive order that at the time was sort of represented by the administration as being the culmination of this promise, the beginning of the construction of this promised border wall. But this EO really turned out to be toothless because you know, they had various groups that were estimating the cost of this budget wall, of the border wall. And it was estimated that, you know, he would need somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 billion to build the wall. That's not something that can be accomplished via executive order. And this descended into a whole standoff with Congress. Some of your listeners might recall there was a government shutdown in late 2018 where Trump was effectively refusing to sign any budget bills that didn't give him the beginning of this huge chunk of billions of dollars he needed to build the wall. And he was really stymied in those efforts, ultimately by the refusal of Congress to send him the enormous amount of funding he needed to build the wall. So this EO did accomplish some border construction. There were some prototypes that were built. Eventually, Trump, and this is one of the things about, you know, using the executive office, Trump was able to sort of take funds that had already been appropriate for the defense budget, for the Pentagon, move them into border wall construction after declaring a national emergency. So there are these legal loopholes that presidents can leverage. But the EO itself, the executive order, was really not instrumental to the construction of any part of this wall other than to commission a few studies. It was really something that revolved around Congress, revolved around Trump finding increasingly difficult to thread legal loopholes to try to build this wall, which he, you know, did not build ultimately.
Now, there were executive orders under Trump's previous time in office that did have lasting effects. Can you talk about what those orders were?
Yeah, so the most notorious probably is, you know, colloquially referred to as the Muslim ban. This was an executive order that barred entry into the U.S. For refugees, people coming from a series of countries, mostly in the Middle East, mostly Muslim-majority countries, though a few other places like North Korea were included. And this had lasting ramifications. It's actually, this is sometimes referred to as one executive order. It was actually a series of his executive orders that were sort of, as one was struck down by the courts, the Trump administration would create another executive order that was somewhat more limited that they thought could pass legal review. But ultimately, you know, this was in place for the duration of his administration. There was a severe curtailment of immigration from those countries. And it wasn't until Joe Biden came into office and lifted this executive order, repealed it, as only presidents are allowed to do, that we saw a relaxation of some of those immigration standards, though Biden did leave others in place.
So a quick follow up on that. I think one of the things that you one of the things that you did mention previously just now was about how with the executive orders, he can't the president can't overturn laws that were already in place or pass laws that would cost money. Or a serious amount of money such that he would need to get some type of budget approval.
Right.
With respect to the Muslim ban, can you elaborate on how the Muslim ban wasn't something that originated under Trump? Because I think a lot of people think it was a new law that he passed, but there was some existing legal precedent there. Am I correct on that or am I wrong?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, for you know, numerous administrations now, there's been a restriction of immigration from countries that the U.S. Deems to be to have sort of higher risk populations. And, you know, I'm not well versed in the process by which they make that determination. But this has been on the books for a while. And I think that what the Trump administration did was they severely limited, or in some cases limited to the point of making the number of allowable immigrations effectively zero, the number of people who could come into the U.S. from those countries. And so what you see when you start to parse these different executive orders, and then also looking at what Biden did after he took office, was that there are parts of this so-called ban that actually are sort of longstanding, desirable parts of immigration policy for, you know, the U.S. immigration apparatus, and that it was really, for Trump, it was this severe curtailment of immigration from particular countries that was notable.
So just one last follow-up on this point. So if executive orders can't overturn laws already in place and they can't pass laws that would require money for the most part, can executive orders create new laws that don't overturn existing laws and that don't require money?
Yeah, and, you know, I just want to be specific to executive orders aren't really laws that are on the books. They're directives from the president. They just they function with sort of the force of the law. And when it comes to funding, you know, presidents can use funds that have already been appropriated by Congress. So what you'll see a lot with executive orders is a presidential administration, and not just Trump. This is broadly true, especially in this century where presidents have increasingly used executive orders as kind of, you know, an outlet for realizing policy. You'll see presidents and administrations find money in different places that Congress has already approved that they then can funnel towards realizing whatever this EO is. It just becomes more complicated, and it opens them to more legal challenges when they start having to do that versus kind of a pure congressional appropriations process. But I think, just as you say, what we see a lot with executive orders is that they're kind of plowing new terrain for what is legally acceptable. So while they're not really backwards looking and they don't deal with the laws that are already on the books, they're kind of opening new avenues of policy and in many cases pushing the boundary of what's allowable under existing law. And I think that this is one of the ways that presidents who know they can't get a particular policy through Congress because of its makeup, because of, you know, what the policy itself says, they'll say, OK, well, let's issue an EO on that basis and then sort of see what shakes out legally. And you saw this over and over again in the Trump administration, but it's not a tactic that's exclusive to that administration. We saw it under Obama. We saw it under George W. Bush. Biden did it, too. So this is increasingly a tactic that presidents, especially in the 21st century, use to open up new arenas of, you know, policy advancement.
So this has been really great historical context and insight to now use this to talk about what can be expected in Trump's first 100 days in office, and how it might be similar to his last first 100 days and how it might be different in terms of these executive orders.
Sure. Yeah. So I think, again, as I said earlier, it's my sense, and this is, you know, not grounded in any sort of research, but it's just my sense that Trump is sort of a fan of executive orders because they do a lot of the things that I think he enjoys. They're flashy. You can have a press conference after you issue one. They go into effect quickly. And so I would expect us to see a lot of executive orders from the jump with this new Trump administration. That's what happened last time, and I think we'll see that again. I think the, you know, differences, though, are that during Trump's last first 100 days, so in 2017, there was a group of people around him that really didn't understand how the White House worked, didn't really understand how Congress worked necessarily. And then there was another group of people who he had sort of imported from the Republican establishment who maybe understood how the federal government worked, but didn't really understand how Trump worked. So I think there were these two contingents who clashed a lot, and we saw this over and over again in the press and, you know, in leaks from within the administration. And I think it contributed to a lot of gridlock at the executive level, because there was, you know, some question about how to implement this policy that was, some of which was pretty far out, even for a right-leaning Republican administration. And Trump himself had, you know, no experience with sort of cajoling members of his party in the House and the Senate. And there was a learning curve. And I think, you know, we're unlikely to see as much of a learning curve this time. The other really important point I want to make about why his forthcoming first 100 days will be more efficacious is that the Republican Party has really changed a lot in the, you know, intervening 8 years between 2017 and 2025 when he'll be in office. And it's really Trump's party now. And so whereas I think we saw a lot of, you know, miscomprehension, a lot of side eyeing from congressional Republicans, clashes with Trump in some cases, it's not the same party now. It's really Trump's party. And I would expect that he'll meet with much less resistance as he tries to get legislation through Congress. So I still think we'll see a lot of EOs, but I wouldn't be surprised to see him using Congress much more than he did in his first term and early on, too, to advance major legislation.
To understand, based on the last Trump administration, what checks there could be on a newly emboldened Donald Trump once he takes office, and to help shed light on what of his campaign promises stretch plausibility and sometimes the bounds of material reality with our guest, Sam Rosenthal, the political director at Roots Action. I actually now want to get into this point you make in your piece about how, quote, Trump makes promises that stretch plausibility and sometimes the bounds of material reality. And that was back during his first administration and the campaign leading up to it, as well as now what we're seeing. Can you elaborate on this and actually provide some examples of how he does this?
Yeah, and I think, you know, when I talk about stretching the bounds of plausibility or material reality, I don't mean that these are things that could never happen, but I mean considering the political climate, considering the amount of capital that Trump would need to move around to realize some of these policy goals, they're just not realistic, even within, you know, the confines of Trump world, where it sometimes feels like reality is not what we thought it was. They're still not really realistic goals. And I think the wall is a good example from his first administration, where it really was just the expenditure, the amount of time and energy and power that was required to do something like build a 30-foot wall across the entire southern U.S. border was just beyond the ambit of what members of his party were willing to follow him to. I think, you know, this term, it's Trump's promise to deport everyone who is in the country undocumented. You know, this is one of his core campaign promises this time around, arguably his most prominent. He's talking about 11 million people by some estimate. So 11 million people is like, you know, 3% of the U.S. population or something. It's an enormous, enormous number of people who would need to be deported from the country if Trump were to realize this policy. He says he's going to implement it. I don't know what that means exactly. You know, we'll see how that unravels, but I think it's just logistically really improbable that he can accomplish anywhere near what he's promising. It would probably cost about $100 billion a year just to implement this policy, and that's bracketing completely the loss to GDP that people are estimating if you suddenly removed, 10 to 15 million people from this country, which would be like in the orbit of $1 trillion or something like that. And that's all leaving aside what would be, you know, an extraordinarily ugly spectacle of watching people in the social media era, watching people be, taken away from their families, from their places of work, from their homes, people who have been in this country for a very long time. People from all walks of life. So I just don't think that this is plausible. But as with everything that Trump says, it's still incumbent on us to try to think, well, what kernels of that policy, what kernels of that promise might we see him try to realize? Because even any part of this, I think, is a really scary reality for lots of people who are currently living in this country. So, it's worth thinking about what Trump might actually try to do and what's actually possible.
And I think what I really appreciate, again, about your work, your articles, and this conversation is really making sure that, for those who, like myself, like you, like many out there who do want to ensure that we are resisting these types of policies, that we are informed on what is true about what can happen, and then therefore to be just more effective and efficient in how we organize against them. And so I want to take that into the next part of this conversation around this idea of the trifecta effect that everyone keeps talking about and is very scared about. But as I pointed out in the opening, as you've pointed out in your work, that in 2017, a lot of people forgot that in Trump's first term, Republicans had the trifecta control of the federal government. And that despite that, Trump's legislative successes during the 115th Congress were viewed as comparatively modest. Can you elaborate on this? Give examples of how his legislative successes during his first administration, even though the first 2 years the Republicans had control of the House and Senate, were comparatively modest, and how this is, how right now we might see, what similarities and differences we might see in this second Trump administration, considering one of the things you brought up, which is that the Republican Party is more of a Trump type of Republican Party. And just one other thing I want to add to that, I'd like to believe that all Republicans aren't homogenous. So can you maybe also highlight where there are those within the Republican Party that will be in the House and Senate that might not necessarily just go along with anything that Trump wants?
Yeah. So as you said, you know, Trump did have a trifecta going into his first term as president. He's really likely to have a trifecta again. You know, the House, there's still some House races that are currently unsettled, but it looks increasingly clear that Republicans will have the House too. So they'll have the House and the Senate and the presidency. I think that, you know, in his first term, some of this, of course, is attributable to what I was discussing earlier, that there was a lot more friction between Trump and the party. And there was a, you know, learning curve where he was trying to figure out how Congress worked and how to do things. But there was, as you say, a great deal of fear, apprehension around what Trump might do. And certainly there were a lot of things that Trump did that, you know, broke norms, longstanding norms in this country, had terrible effects for particular communities in this country. But one thing he didn't do in his first term was pass some of the major legislation that would have really restructured kind of the U.S. government, the way the U.S. federal government works. You'll recall that Trump came into office saying he was going to drain the swamp in 2017. And there were all these implications, you know, made by Trump and by others in his administration, that he was going to sort of strip the federal government down to, you know, take it down to the studs and rebuild it in his image. And that really didn't happen. The most significant legislation probably that we saw in that Congress was the Trump tax cut. And this is, you know, a tax cut that was basically a huge giveaway to corporations. It lowered the corporate tax rate. It addressed things like estate tax and gift tax, which are really kind of taxes that only really wealthy people care about. But this is kind of like meat and potatoes stuff for any Republican administration. You know, it's hard to see how we wouldn't have gotten some kind of tax cut for the wealthy with any garden variety Republican with trifecta control in the White House. And then the other major legislative battle you saw during the first half of Trump's presidency there, before Democrats retook the House, was that Trump, you know, was this sort of stop start in this attempt to repeal or change the ACA, you know, otherwise known as Obamacare. And that was ultimately an effort that was doomed by Trump's own party. So when it comes to, you know, this incoming administration and incoming Congress, I think it's worth thinking about that Obamacare, the attempts to repeal Obamacare, that example. It is harder for me to conceive of a number of senators in Trump's own party bucking him on, you know, what's a signature piece of policy legislation he's trying to get through in this term. I just think the party's changed a lot and there is less of an appetite for really taking Trump on in that respect. But having said that, there are still, especially in the House, there were a lot of very close races. Republicans won. You know, I think that Republicans in purple districts who won tight races this year should already be very worried about the midterms. Midterms historically are not good for whichever party's in the White House. You know, it's heavily contingent on Trump having delivered some policy that they can really run on in the midterms, which if his first term is any indication, he's really not very good at doing. So we might see defections in the House where there's going to be a very tight margin. In the Senate, I think that's less likely to happen. You know, Republicans have a pretty good margin in the Senate now as far as these things go. And so I don't feel very optimistic about the possibility of a mass revolt against Trump from within his own party. except maybe at the margins in those really competitive swing House districts.
And sorry, we just have a minute left. So if you can, in a minute, I'm sorry to put this on you, but talk about ways that Trump's power can still be reined, not just by Congress, but outgoing President Biden, state and local legislatures, and actually through the filibuster process.
Sure. So let me take them very quickly, one by one. So, you know, the current Congress is also divided. So there are some attempts in the Senate right now to pass laws that might stymie Trump when he gets into office, but it's really unlikely we'll see those get through Congress. In sort of the same way, Biden can pass a series of executive orders